Good evening. Welcome to the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. Enter freely and of your own will. In this episode, you may find many strange things, for the films to be discussed are old, and they have many memories. So, beware. Beware.
In this episode of the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast, a conniving woman who works at a circus seeks to infiltrate a tight-knit group of social outsiders and learns, to her disadvantage, what it truly means to be a freak. This is the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast. I'm Jim Towns. I'm with my co-host, Livio Marino. Hey, Livio.
Hey, hey.
And we're going to cover what's probably the most infamous film we've talked about on the show, right? And probably will continue to be the most of, I mean, Freaks is just, its reputation precedes it, even people who haven't possibly seen it.
Yeah, it's actually, it's one of those movies that I had heard about and seen pictures of and everything, like, you know, ever since I was into classic horror, see them in the books and see it talked about and documentaries and such. And this was actually my first time watching it just a few weeks back, so.
You're a new viewer. That's amazing.
I am a new viewer.
That's great. It of course is directed by Todd Browning, hot off the heels of the success of Dracula. Todd Browning was, and I always forget this, Todd Browning really actually was under contract for MGM, and he was loaned out to Universal to do Dracula. Like, he was really an MGM director. I always forget that. And then you look at at this time he was an MGM, because he had left. He'd been with Universal and left, right, with Chaney.
Yes. Yeah, he was, because Chaney was...
I might have this wrong. I think Chaney left.
Yeah, so, yeah, Chaney left, and he was definitely MGM kind of locked in there. And that's one of the big things, you know, it's kind of almost like an old wives' tale at this point about Chaney Sr. being Dracula, you know, with the assumption that he would just follow Todd Browning because of their relationship. But I don't think that would have happened. I think that Chaney was so, I guess, bitter, for lack of a better term, towards Universal. And I don't think MGM would have been willing to give him up, you know, to be honest. So,
yeah, it makes sense. That's right. Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before, that we doubt MGM would have been okay with that. But they're okay loaning out Browning, I guess. So,
yeah.
But this is Browning post, you know, I think we should talk about Todd a minute here for this. Like, I think in looking back at it now, I kind of think of Browning as, like, you know, Browning's Dracula wasn't really, I don't know, for Browning at least, I don't know if that was, he saw that as the highlight of his career. I think he was happiest doing the silent era stuff with Chaney, and then once Chaney dies and sound comes in, you're seeing Browning at kind of post apex.
Yeah,
of his thing. Yeah, I don't know, and I don't even know if he was he happy doing Dracula. It does. I mean, in modern looking back recently of it, it doesn't sound like Dracula was. How do I say it? I'm not sure Dracula was a positive experience for Todd Browning. Actually, I mean, it was a positive experience for the rest of us. Obviously,
You know, and there are several reports of that Browning really didn't do much. Reports like Carl Freund took a lot of the reins, you know, under themselves to try to get things done. And to be honest, you can see a pretty stark difference between, and I know you've recently talked about this, but between the English and the Spanish version of Dracula.
For sure.
You know, there were several around this time, you know, 1929, 30, and 31, there's several stars, silent film stars, that just didn't make the transition to sound very well for whatever reason. You know, Norman Carey was one, you know, big star, Phantom of the Opera, The Unknown, all this stuff, but just fell off as soon as sound came on. I kind of think that Todd Browning is that way just from a directorial, you know, point of view. If you look at Dracula, the English version of Dracula, it's very, very much, you know, you kind of have a stationary camera. It's almost like you're watching a play. You know, on a theater, it's very stage-like that. The camera doesn't move. It's not. But, you know, you go to other movies that are, you know, less than a year later under different directors, and it's, it's so much more grand and different and
Mummy, Invisible Man,
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, Frankenstein. This, you know, was literally months later. You know, James Whale was, you know, leaps and bounds ahead of what Browning did with Dracula. So
it almost, I think the modern term we'd apply would almost be phoning it in a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think Browning was so talented that even his version of phoning it in a little bit is still miraculous to some degree, but because not to impugn the man at all. But I think it's interesting that after Dracula, he comes back to MGM, and with the success of Dracula, Irving Thalberg tells him I want you to make something horrifying, just like Dracula. And it's almost like Browning heard the horrifying part, but not the just like Dracula part.
Yeah.
And so he comes up and the legend goes that Harry Earls, the main actor in the film, the person of short stature, lead actor in this, who plays Hans, brought him this story called Spurs, written by Todd Robbins, as a possible, because Harry had worked on both versions of The Unholy Three with Browning, the silent and the sound version.
Yes.
So they were like buds. And he was like, hey, there's this story that actually is about small people, and it's kind of up your alley, and you should. And apparently that, you know, the legend is that's how it gets started, and then it goes through the script department and stuff. So the end result is, if anybody hasn't seen the movie, you owe it to yourself, especially in this episode, to really make sure you watch the movie and then listen to this episode, because it's worth
it. It will not make sense unless you have
some,
sort of frame
really
of reference.
You're really going to have a hard frame of reference, because I was going to say. It goes all the way through the script version and into filming before Louis B. Mayer, one of the heads of MGM, starts seeing these actors that have been cast walking around the thing, and he's like, what is happening here?
Hang on. Yeah.
And Thalberg ends up arguing him into continue letting the film be, because he wants to shut the film down. And you know, because there's all these people that are, and everybody, just off the bat, I'm going to be using a couple phrases in this episode. I did some research just to make sure, because I really don't want to insult anybody, anybody's memory or anything. I'm going to be using a few phrases like non-normative physical people and physically compromised, you know, things like that. I will be using the word freaks sometime to refer to the characters, but only as the group, not as the individual actors, because I don't consider them freaks. They're just the actors of this, and they had their own physical issues. But having said that, they're like all these non-normative people were suddenly on the set of MGM, and you know, there's all this problem with like them eating in the cafeteria. They had to put them in a tent outside. They wouldn't let them eat in the cafeteria. It just caused all this craziness, and it's like almost like Todd Browning was blamed for pulling one over on everybody, kind of. And I don't see it. It's funny and how much that is like a post hoc story, because obviously, like, you know, he didn't just secretly make this movie. He had a casting agent touring all over the East Coast, all sorts of circuses and carnivals, and all these actors came from all over the country in Canada to fill these roles and stuff, because this was obviously not something that you could cast a normal a physically normal actor in these roles, and that's what makes this film. It's a one-off. I mean, even in some of the opening stuff in literature about the movie, they say, like, there'll never be another movie like this. Like, they knew there wouldn't be. And they were right. In the 92 years since, there's obviously never been another movie like this. It's a one-off, and it's exciting to be able to talk about it.
It is. And you know, you have to give Browning credit because, one, I mean, just in reference to what I was saying about him earlier, I still think he's a very talented director and did a lot of great things. I just don't necessarily think he handled the transition to sound all that well. But that being said, you also have to give him credit, and Thalberg credit as well, that they didn't rely on a bunch of effects or makeup or, you know, things that quite honestly, a lot of the other studios at the time, and even studios today, would probably do, as opposed to just casting, just at people, normal people,
yeah,
who happen to be, you know, small or you know, whatever the case may be. So
it's like Browning had lost Lon Chaney, who in movies like West of Zanzibar and Unholy Tree and stuff could transform himself into something resembling an abnormal physical shape. It's like he didn't have that, so he's like, well, I guess I'll just go with the real thing. And my main, you know, the main thing I love about this movie is, as someone who works in this business and is confronted with this all the time, is that the film industry as an art form is so focused on beauty. It really is. I mean, if you think about, every actor, part of actor's job, unless you're a character actor, you know, part of your job is to be attractive, whether we're talking about David Manners or Myrna Loy or Rock Hudson or George Clooney, you know, I mean, the industry trades on beauty, and Browning intentionally just gave that the biggest middle finger, you know?
Yes.
You know what? I'm going to do a movie and I'm going to intentionally challenge your idea of what a lead actor and a lead character can be. And he did in 1932, way before, you know, so many movements to bring different types of people equality under in our culture. It's a bizarro masterpiece. It really is. And it's no surprise that it was like in the 60s that this film started making its real comeback, and being appreciated at a time when counterculture and other issues were, and equality issues were really, you know, on the table in our culture. To get into it, the film stars Harry Earls as Hans. He was in The Unholy Three, both versions. Like I said, he was also in The Wizard of Oz, and he's an actor of short stature. Daisy Earls plays Frida, his fiance, but Daisy was actually Harry's sibling in real life. So their affection on screen, this is one thing I think is funny, is their affection on screen is kept to quite a minimum, because it's like Browning was all about taboos, but there was a limit, right?
Yes. Yeah.
We're not going to go there. Olga Baklanova, I think. Yeah, there you go. Plays Cleopatra. She was in The Man Who Laughs, which starred Conrad Veidt. Henry Victor plays Hercules. He was in Sherlock Holmes and the Secret Weapon. Roscoe, is it 80s? Addies? I don't know. Plays Roscoe, the stuttering clown. He has an uncredited role in King Kong as one of the photographers. Wallace Ford plays Frozo. We know Wallace obviously from The Mummy's Hand and Mummy's Tomb. And it's neat to see him here like about 10 years earlier than that.
Yes.
A little more slender.
Just a bit.
Leela Himes from Island of Dr. Moreau plays Venus. And then we also, then we have a list of the Carnival cast members, including Josephine Joseph, Daisy and Violet Hilton, Schlitzy, Johnny Eck, Angelo Rosito, Prince Randian, Francis O'Connor, Peter Robinson, and Olga Roderick. The story, again, is based on Spurs by Clarence Aaron / Todd Robbins, with a screenplay by Willis Goldbeck and Leon Golden, and Charles MacArthur did uncredited work and additional dialogue.
There's also two, I guess you would call them cameos, from the Universal alumni, I guess you can call them that, Michael Visseroff, who's the innkeeper in Dracula. Very recognizable with the same mustache and same voice, but he's walking.
He's pretty much doing the same character.
Yeah, he is. And it's the very beginning of the movie, but he's walking with an actor by the name of Albert Conti, who was one half of the comedy relief police duo in 1934's The Black Cat.
Oh, is he? Oh, he's the Visseroff, or he's not Pistian, right?
Yeah, he's Gumbush. Gumbush.
He's Gumbush. Yeah. He's Gumbush, not Pistian. There we go. Those two, they should have had their own movie.
They should have.
The film was originally 90 minutes long and edited down to just over 60 minutes by Irving Thalberg, and most of that, not by him himself, under his orders, obviously. He wasn't there with, like, a razor blade. Most of that extra footage is now lost. Some additional footage, I think, was shot to fill in some stuff at the end. But there was a premiere screening of the uncut film at the Fox Theater in San Diego that broke records for the theater. And they advertised it as like, this is the only chance you're going to get to watch this film in its entirety. So it was very popular. It was banned in many states and foreign countries for years. And there's some states that have never rescinded those bans. So technically, I guess Freaks is illegal to watch in some states in the U.S. Which I guess there's a lot of things that are illegal in some states in the U.S. now.
That's true.
looking at recent news, so I guess it's not surprising. Anyway, it was withdrawn and shelved by MGM, and the distribution rights were kind of given away, and it was sort of toured around on a double bill with what would now be sort of referred to as a nudie film. So I think they did kind of late night. This is the one thing and we'll get into the movie, everybody, of course, but you gotta hear me wax on about it a little bit first. Price of admission. It feels like a movie that was made by some independent, crazy kind of production company trying to, get attention based on its outrageous nature.
Yeah.
But this is an American studio film. This is made by MGM. At the same time, they're making like big, like romance movies and stuff. This crazy movie was made by a studio. That delights me in a way. I think that's really neat.
Yeah, definitely.
We are going to get into Freaks, 1932. We have a sort of, and I think, I don't know if this was, this has to be originally part of the production where the Carnival Barker's talking about, and I'm going to say Freaks, but it's, and we'll come back to it where he's basically, it's a bookend thing where he's talking about the fate of Cleopatra. So this happens after the rest of the film takes place. We have a little bit of exposition where he talks about the code of these people and how if you offend one, you offend them all. And then he shows people something in a pit that we can't see. And they're all, they all pretty much have the same reaction as audiences did in 1932 when this film came out. They're just horrified. The film was upon its initial release, an absolute flop. It lost tons of money. It got terrible reviews. It was complained about. A woman blamed it for having a miscarriage after having watched it. It was just
wow.
It's like all the things they almost wanted to claim for Dracula and Frankenstein, this movie actually sort of delivered on with the audience reaction. People really did pass out. We start the actual timeline of the film with Hans, who is I've never been quite sure what Hans's role in the carnival is. He wears a tuxedo. Yeah. Is he kind of a ringmaster or an announcer?
Maybe. I mean, I just kind of, I guess this is now that I'm thinking about it out loud, a poor assumption on my part. But I just kind of figured that since, he was little, that that was just the attraction. You know,
his job is just being a little person, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You know, to kind of fit in with the, excuse the phrase, but just fit in with the other freaks that are just, being paraded around as part of the act.
Yes. That is interesting. And I wonder if his part in the film is part of what is lost in to the edit of the movie. I'm not sure. His fiance Frida rides a little pony in a kind of a ballet dress type thing. And that's kind of her act. They're watching Cleopatra do her trapeze act. And Hercules, who is the circus strongman, is doing his strong act. Hans is obviously smitten by Cleopatra, but he's engaged to Frida. So instantly we have this kind of little bit of it's a love triangle. I mean, it really, the film actually just has a love triangle with. I'm sorry. Hercules is not lifting weights; he's fighting a bull. I apologize.
Yeah. I mean, same.
I apologize to the bull, too.
I know, me speaking personally, if I tried to lift weights, I imagine it'd be exactly like trying to fight a bull. It's just ridiculously hard. Yeah.
It's prophetic that he fights with the bull because it's that phrase of, mess with the bull, get the horns kind of thing. It's kind of what happens to him in this movie. So there you go. Maybe that was intentional. Cleopatra enjoys messing with Hans, and she's you know, aware that he has a crush on her. And she also enjoys how much it bothers Frida. So right from the start, we see the, you know, she's lacking in moral character or whatever. And I do like how, as we get into the film, we talk about like the heroic or the normative physical characters that we're supposed to like Frozo and Venus, they treat the non-normative members of the circus just like anyone else. You know, the whole idea is there's this little culture, and whether you are typical or atypical physically, it doesn't matter. Everyone's treated the same. The villainous characters we see, like Cleopatra and like Hercules, look down on these characters, no pun intended, and treat them, you know, with hostility and ignorance. So, you know, while the film itself, you know, I and my sort of overall thesis here, so we can get moving on with the film, is, you know, the film is called an exploitation film and was accused when it came out of exploiting these actors who are in the film, these non-normative physical actors. I think if any of the film treats all these characters as characters with, you know, with humor and jealousy and all the emotions that anyone else has. I think the film exploits our fascination with someone who is not, who we view as different. Right. I mean, it's the audience that's getting exploited in this film. And I think that's just, it's such a subversive, you know, approach. And I think it shows Browning knowing exactly what he was doing and what movie he was making.
Yeah, I know. And I was going to kind of point something similar at, like, towards the end, that they do a really good job, I feel, of, I mean, I guess you could argue that parts are, you know, quote unquote exploitation, but really the only thing that you could, I guess, say that is just the fact that he's showing everybody in their conditions just on the screen.
Right.
But beyond that, I mean, that they all have, you know, character to them. They all seem to be doing well, mean to do well. You know, yeah. There's nobody that's a villain the only people in the story that have any bad intentions, that are, you know, kind of the quote unquote freaky, disgusting characters, are the normal ones, you know? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's topsy turvy. Yeah, it's great. And obviously that's the conceit of the film from the start. So I don't know if there's an idea that in some people's head that Browning sort of always lucked into doing smart or brilliant things or poignant things. And I definitely don't think that's the case. I think he very intentionally crafted this film to be what it was. As Livia mentioned, a landowner and his helper, played by Albert Conti and Michael Vizeroff, they confront a bunch of the circus folk who are in. They're technically on the landowner's property. Michael Vizeroff is the guy. He wants them to kick him off, and he's disgusted by them. So he sort of typifies like the normal reaction to people like this. And right from the start, we see this landowner guy going like, no, that's okay, no, please, you know, because their caretaker comes to him and says, they're like children, they're just not, you know, they don't mean any harm, they don't get to go out in the sun much, they stay intense and are stared at all the time. And the landowner is very kind and says, please, you know, please, anytime they want to come in and hang out here, it's fine. So we right away see kind of two faces of tolerance and intolerance typified in these two characters. This first scene showcases quite a few of the quote freaks, including Johnny Eck, who's billed as half boy. He was born with just nothing, no legs and really kind of nothing below his waist. And he learned to ambulate around on just using his arms. And he's also like a very good looking guy. It's the contrast of, you know, if you just saw him from the chest up, he just looks like a guy. And he looks like an actor. We talk about being handsome enough to be a typical actor. He's there. He seems to have the most, like, his story seems to be the least sad of most of these cast members. I keep in mind, this is 1932. There's no American Disability Act going on. These people are not collecting anything monthly. When you're born this way, your options are incredibly limited. And most of these actors did spend most of their time in carnivals and sideshows. The characters they're playing are very much based on their real life, and they were often exploited and often, mistreated. We see Angelo Rosito, who is a person of small stature as well. He was also in The Corpse Vanishes, and he's also in, and this took me forever to realize, he's in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Oh, really?
He's Master to Blaster in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome from 1983, I want to say it. He's the old little guy in that. I mean, talk about a career. Like, it's incredible. Like, he goes from that to that. It's incredible. And he's great. And he actually has a lot of the, obviously some of these people were not actors by trade. They had other occupations. And so some of them, as a filmmaker, you work with people who are not trained professional actors, and some people naturally can kind of do it, and some people have less ability. And then obviously some of these people were hampered by other factors. But Angelo, you could tell, like, he could kind of act. So he obviously went on and did other movies too. And he's got a great look and everything. We also see, Prince Randian, who plays the living torso. He was a guy who had no arms and no legs. He's a head and a slightly small torso. And we see a few of the, what at the time were called pinheads. They suffer from a disease called microencephaly, where the brain does not form. The brain does not grow and form right as in very early life. And so the skull doesn't expand too. So they have these kind of small heads there. And the main, character is played by a guy named Schlitzie, who's a man, even though he plays a woman in this. Schlitzie was also mentally retarded, so he had that going on too. He had quite a few kind of things. And he's one of those characters where, you look him up and nobody knows when he was born, what he did in his early life. And he barely existed on the thing. And that's what to move on with the story. But my point is, like, if you want to talk about exploiting these people, like, they got to come to LA and have jobs for a while and probably get treated halfway decently. So, the hope is that this helped them a little bit, even if it did sort of expose them to public scrutiny, to some degree. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure audiences of 1932 were probably a little bit less understanding of things as we would be today.
Some maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. My thing is, so the film is supposedly set in the United States, but when they filmed it, I think they intended it to not be, because I would say one of the real challenges of this movie for just a viewer coming in cold to it is everybody pretty much, except for maybe Wallace Ford and one or two other characters, has accents. Cleopatra, Hercules, Hans especially. Half of Hans's dialogue is in German at the first top of the film. And the film hasn't been preserved, at least to my knowledge. I don't know if maybe there's been a recent really good restoration of the film, but most versions of the film I've seen are not in the greatest shape. They're not the greatest transfer. So the mixture of slightly poor sound quality, and then the fact that everybody has an accent, and also, Harry Earls's voice is quite high pitched, him being a person of very short stature. So it does make a lot of the dialogue a little difficult to follow.
So, Criterion Collection released Freaks. It's a three pack. It just came out this past year. Freaks, The Unknown, and The Mystic. They call it Todd.
Oh, that was in this. Okay,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, Todd Browning's sideshow, Shockers. That's actually how I watched it. And so I think now I don't have a frame of reference to earlier editions or earlier releases of the film, but it's not the best, but it's not terrible. I think there are parts, especially the very end scene, where it's just so blurry and the sound is so just kind of muddy. But those are kind of few and far between. I think overall, it definitely is aged, but it isn't terrible.
It's just the nature of this not being this film being orphaned a little bit by MGM, right? It wasn't. Yeah. I don't know if it was preserved as well as some of MGM's other pieces from the thing. We get into sort of the culture of the sideshow where, people are having romances, people are breaking up, people are, talking about each other. There's rumors, there's everything. Everyone has their own little wagon, or they share some wagons. And of course some folks are quite friendly with each other, and some people there's animosity and stuff. It's a little subculture, and that's all there is to it. We meet Venus, who is, I'm not sure what Venus's job in the circus is either, but that's okay. She's played by Lele Himes from Island Dr. Moreau. She plays the wife in Island Dr. Moreau who comes to the island. She has been in a relationship with Hercules, the strong man, who's played by Henry Victor. And she's leaving him. She's tired. Oh, we see her with seals. So I think she does some kind of act with seals.
Oh, okay.
Which we don't. Yeah. An unspecified. I forgot there's that one shot of her putting a seal away. So yeah, she obviously does some, maybe it's one of those things where, remember like in, you see in cartoons where the seal plays different horns and stuff that, they're trained to do little tricks and stuff. And I guess that's what she does. She doesn't play the horn. She has the seals play the horn. Anyway, she's leaving Hercules. And there's this idea that Hercules was with her and he built her out of some money or something. I'm not sure what that's about, but
I was going to say, it's almost as if, I don't think trope is the right word, but it's interesting how, that this is supposed to be a quote unquote, a sideshow, a circus, it's going to be some very unique, thing with everybody, all these cast of characters involved. But the reality is it's no different than any other, community. It's that people are just generally wanting to find love, wanting to be accepted. And then you have the normal drama of, you got a guy that's obviously is, thinks somebody looks pretty. And so he probably tells her whatever she wants to hear. And then she winds up doing things and giving him money. And then of course that's where we come in on this scene where she's realizing all this and then regrets it. And, having kind of big falling out.
And it goes back to like kind of a classic Browning thing where so many of his films and the stories he wrote for his films, have to do with people scamming people or getting money or the greed factor and stuff. Unholy Three, all these movies. And this ends up being kind of a scam film where Cleopatra is going to pretend to be in love with Hans to try and, because she finds out in spoilers that he actually has an inheritance. And she's already borrowing money from him, kind of, because he's obviously well off. And so she's going to pretend to love him and marry him. And then they're going to, she colludes with Hercules to off him and get his money and stuff. So it's like you said, just like normal culture, there's some nice people that are just looking for love and, trying to find their way through life. And there's some people who are trying to take advantage of others. So there we go. So Venus leaves Hercules, and kind of runs into Frozo, who's played by Wallace Ford, who's a clown in the thing. And Frozo is a physically normative person mostly, because there's sort of instantly a budding little something between them, but he has this line where he says, "You should have caught me before my operation," which I'm not sure what that refers to. Huh. I've never caught that before. It's just this last time I thought that was really funny. We've we uh we have a moment where we meet Josephine Joseph, the half woman, half man. So this person is split down the middle and wears the costume where it, on one half is looks like a female, the other half looks like a man. And there's a funny moment where they walk by Hercules and Roscoe, the other clown, says, you know, I think she likes you, but he don't.
Yeah.
So there's also, and throughout the film, there's also this very, it's subtle. There's this subversive idea of the gender fluid and the, you know, like that kind of thing happening too, because it's like within this subculture of, you know, wherever the film is set, whether it's America or Europe or whatever's going on, those things that are taboos in normal culture become less taboo here, obviously, because it's kind of like all bets are off and there's that line between, you know, gender and orientation and everything like that is a little more blurry here. Things are accepted here that are not as commonly accepted in normal society, is my point. For instance, we also meet Daisy and Violet Hilton, who are real life conjoined twins. And they had a rough early time. They were forced to perform, but they're born to like a barmaid, and the midwife who birthed them took them under her whatever and forced them to perform and didn't pay them very well and didn't treat them very well until they managed to emancipate themselves when they're 23. They did this film and they did Chained for Life. But their later life, they kind of lived in poverty for quite a few years. And they worked at a grocery store and had hot dog stands and things. Within the film, so they're joined at the hip, and Daisy is engaged to Roscoe, the stuttering clown, played by Roscoe Atis. And then Violet ends up getting engaged to a different guy, and it makes for great comedy because it's so complicated. Because like Daisy is in love with or likes Roscoe, and but he's like, well, you know, you're my wife, and you're going to do this. And then Violet's like, no, we're not. And she's leaving. Like, it gets complicated, I guess, is my point. Especially when there's going to be two different men married to them. And they're like, well, you're going to have to come visit us sometime. Like, you have to come visit us sometime. And you're left going like, I'm not sure how that's going to work, but all right.
I mean, it, again, something else that is also fairly topical.
yes.
Today, it's a similar story floating around. In current times.
Yes, exactly. And just, it's like my point, like accommodations had to be made with these people who were not, you know, were atypical. Hercules visits Cleopatra, cause now he's single and she makes him eggs. And they're kind of instantly on each other. Right. Cause they're, I'll just use the phrase, they're normies. they spot Josephine Joseph spying on them and Hercules smacks them. Hans is trying to bring her the money and she doesn't want him to see Hercules. So, and she says something like, you'll ruin everything. So she's already kind of, you know, she's working Hans, obviously, and she wants Hans to think that, you know, she only has eyes for him, obviously. So the entire film, they're, you know, she and Hercules are going to try and keep their kind of their dalliance secret. Let's see what happens. The bearded lady has a girl, and everyone gets cigars from her husband, the human skeleton, which is great because the bearded lady is also not tiny. So they sort of do the two things. They do the bearded lady and the big lady kind of gag there.
And I like Wallace Ford's line. He's like, oh, it's a girl and it's going to have a beard.
yeah, exactly. Wallace Ford really like. The films, you know, again, we have a lot of actors who are not super professional actors. We have a lot of things. And Wallace Ford and Lila Himes' sort of romance and comedy sort of really bridges us through a lot of these little scenes and stuff. I mean, they're funny and they're a good team up together. Again, they're these two. They're outsiders as well. Like, you know, they're not. They're physically normal, but they're also social outsiders. They, you know, they're a circus. They're circus folk, right?
Yeah, he's and I kind of thought of this of, you know, especially at the just at the end of the movie, and then going through my notes that, you know, I think Wallace Ford is a much better actor than I think he's generally given credit for, both at the time that he was, you know, active in making movies and even today. He's able to bring a sense of realism to sometimes very outlandish roles, this being one of them.
Yeah.
He also, I mean, there's other great things you can check him out as, you know, like there's a movie, I think it was made in 1936, called Absolute Quiet, where he's plays this like robber with a conscience, opposite Lionel Atwell of all people. He does good in that. Right. Obviously, we know him from The Mummy's Hand and then The Mummy's Tomb. And he did Mice and Men on the stage.
Wow. I would have liked to have seen that version. That's cool.
And he actually he worked very closely with Lon Chaney Jr. When Chaney was really, you know, going after being Lenny to kind of walk him through some of the scenes and how things should go and, you know, stuff like that. So he's a pretty good actor.
Yeah. But did he play George or Lenny?
I think he played George. I think
he must have played George, right? Because he's talking. Yeah. The Burgess Meredith role, basically. Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. The circus folk are on to Cleopatra from the start. Like, it's like Hans is the only one who can't see it. Frida, you know, has conversations with Venus about it, and it's funny because it's like they're girlfriends, right? They're just doing girl talk while Frida's hanging up her laundry and stuff. And this is, again, my point, like, Frozo and Venus and stuff, they don't see these people as different. They're just, they're their friends and they're all in this together. It's great. Wallace Ford's character, Frozo, I should mention, Frozo is the character's name for Lon Chaney's character in West of Zanzibar, which is absolutely my favorite Lon Chaney film. Practically, it's really demented. It's about a stage magician who becomes crippled and ends up moving to Africa and pretends to be a witch doctor. And the his wife leaves him for another man, and then he thinks that they have a daughter, but it turns out it's his daughter. But he keeps her addicted to opium stuff. It is so dark and freaking twisted and wacky. it's really wild, but it's an amazing performance. I think it was remade as Conga. One of those in the 30s as a sound film. But anyway, his character in the when he's the magician in that film is called Frozo. So here's Browning, you know, reusing that name.
And I think Lionel
for a much, much friendlier character.
And I think Lionel Barrymore is in that one too,
as
the guy who Chaney assumes is the father of his own.
Is he? Family. I thought Lionel Barrymore was in the remake.
Was he? Maybe I'm getting those confused.
I'm not sure. I think he plays Frozo in and slash Dead Legs Pete or whatever his name is in the remake. But yeah, we were just talking about the Barrymore's last episode and for our Jekyll and Hyde episode. The running gag with Frozo is that you know he likes Venus quite a lot, and Venus is liking him, but Frozo's really dedicated to his work. And so every time they start getting close to being a little romantic or they start complimenting each other or whatever, Frozo gets distracted with a gag. Like he's got this
the
clown suit thing where she hits him in the head with the thing, it goes up. And yeah, there's a great bit with the bathtub where she comes up and starts talking to him and he has his shirt off and it looks like he's sitting in the bathtub and she's leaning way over looking into the bathtub. And there's a moment where you're like, this is 1932. What am I watching? And then you realize the joke is that it's a fake bathtub and he can climb out of it and carry it around and everything. And he had this idea for the gag and he's just been, you know, rolling with it. So yeah, anyway, it is funny. Again, it's Browning just messing with where the edge of the taboo exists, and whatnot. Um, uh, So we do get a chance to meet a few of the other characters in a better way on the thing, including again Angelino, Prince Randian, Schlitzie, the other two microencephalitic characters were Elvira and Jenny Lee Snow. They play the other two "quote unquote pinheads," as well as one of my favorite characters is the Bird Girl, who's played by Elizabeth Green. I'm not sure what her physical issue was that she dealt with. But they dressed her up kind of like a little bit of a bird with a feather on her head, and she just, that was her role. Like, I don't know if that was her character in the sideshows when, you know, she was cast in this or what her deal was. And then we meet Frances O'Connor, who's the armless girl who could eat and do all sorts of things with her feet. She was kind of famous for that. And she's very pretty, and despite her physical issues, she apparently got lots of marriage proposals and was really sought after by a lot of guys, but apparently never got married. Yeah.
She had options.
She did. She did have options. She chose not to go for it. Frida finally confronts Hans about Cleopatra. And they have like a breakup scene. Like, these two characters have a scene just like a scene would be like with any other, you know, normative characters. And he apologizes, saying he's been weak and he sort of should have broken up with her earlier than this. He should have been honest that he has feelings for. It's kind of an infatuation that he has with Cleopatra. And even Frida kind of calls him on it, and she says something like, "You think being with her will make you more normal, kind of. But we're your people. You know, we're the ones that accept you and stuff." And she just she laughs behind your back, and he doesn't believe it. He wants to believe that she really does. Go ahead.
No, I'd say this is a heartbreaking scene. And she plays it so well. Daisy Earls is the actress, she's so, like, you can tell how much she really truly loves him, but at the same time, she's heartbroken over what he's, you know, doing, and she can also see the path that this is going down, and so she's just got all of these emotions that she's trying to keep in, and it's just she does such a great job at being so subtle, she's not over the top, she's not raising her voice or crying, but you just see like the tears welling up and just kind of the shakiness of her voice, and it is heartbreaking.
Absolutely. You get the sense that Frida sort of got those tears out, and she prepared herself for this, and she kind of knows what the end of this conversation is going to be.
Yeah.
And she just knows she has to go through it anyway. Browning does an amazing job of the most of the conversation takes place in Hans's wagon, which is a smaller sized wagon, you know, it proportionally for him. And Browning does a great thing of keeping because they're kind of up in the wagon, the camera can be lower. And so he films them when they have a close-up or a medium shot, like a, you know, head to chest. He films them from the same height as proportionally as you would film a normative-sized actor. So he's not filming down at them. He's not, like, there's moments here where, because there's no other normal-sized characters in the scene, you can forget their proportions because both Harry and Daisy Earls were more or less normally proportioned people. They were just smaller, as opposed to Angelo Rossetti, whose head is kind of large and whatnot. So you kind of forget that they're different, and you're just, again, like we said, you're just seeing these two characters having a heartbreaking scene. Sort of free of Frida now, though. Hans, starts giving more lavish gifts like jewelry and whatnot to Cleopatra, and to the point where Frida finally, you know, kind of has to confront her and say, like, look, I know your intentions aren't good with Hans and stuff, but I can't help that and everything. And she kind of pleads with her one little time. And what she ends up doing is accidentally telling Cleopatra that Hans is set to inherit a fortune.
Yeah.
And this is what spurns, because again, you know, Hercules is there with her and there, you know, he has to go hide in this whole thing and stuff. And there's also a subtext that, like, everybody's drinking a lot throughout all the characters, both the normal and non-normative characters are all drinking constantly in this movie. Cleopatra and Hercules definitely seem to be drunk on wine most of the time. But yeah, so this is what sets, Cleopatra on the road to, like, okay, I'm going to marry. And she uses, terrible slurs against him. Like, she calls him the little polywog and he calls him, Hercules calls him the little ape. But again, yeah, because Frida thinks Cleopatra's after Hans for his inheritance, she tips her off about it and not realizing that she didn't know it. And so now the plan is hatched that she's going to marry Hans, and then they will poison him and they will take the money and do whatever they want. So, yeah. You know, we're in 1932, so we're really almost height of just past the height of the Great Depression at this point. So you can imagine, like, life was tough for people in cities with jobs and things like that who existed within the mainstream culture in America. You can only imagine how hard it was when you were someone, like, you know, on the outskirts of normal culture trying to get by. So no wonder you're drinking all the time, I guess.
It was the Depression.
Yeah. I don't know. Prohibition was over by this time, right? I'm not sure when Prohibition was. Yeah. So there's a wedding feast. And I guess if there's two famous, really famous scenes in the movie, it's the wedding feast, and then it's the scene in the rain, obviously towards the end. But the whole carnival sits at a big long table and they're celebrating the wedding of Hans to Cleopatra, who sit at the head of the table. The bird girl is dancing on the table. Hercules and Cleopatra are getting really drunk as well. Almost so drunk that they start kissing each other and Hans gets mad about it. But the other thing is that they have a special bottle just for Hans of champagne, and they're adding poison to it. So they've begun the plan to whack the little man. The big part of the thing is the One of Us song. So all the freaks, quote, get together and decide they're going to make Cleopatra one of them, truly. And they do this by, it's the big cup thing where they fill a cup with, it looks like beer, I think. I'm not sure. Maybe it's sparkling wine, of some kind. And they all drink from it one by one, and it goes down the table as Angelo carries it, this giant goblet of alcohol. And they all drink of it. Schlitzie drinks from it. The bird girl drinks from it. You know, the bearded lady drinks from it. And you see Cleopatra staring at it as it gets closer and closer to it, and in growing horror that she's going to have to drink after all of these other people who she thinks are disgusting. And it outs her because she freaks out and she calls them all freaks to their faces and tells them all to go away. And you know, the moment, the feel, the frivolity just stops dead. And all these, you feel terrible. All these poor people just turn around and they leave. You know, they're all, you know, they're so insulted, right? And they're insulted for Hans's sake as well, which is, it's a hard scene to watch, because she makes fun of Hans, and then she puts him on her shoulders and carries him around, and he covers his face. He's so humiliated. It's, you know, I talk about, like, setting a villain up so that you want to see bad things happen to him. And I'm not sure what's a better example of that than this.
Yeah.
You're just, at this point, now you're just waiting for something awful to happen to Cleopatra and Hercules, not least because they're trying to kill the guy, but also it's just their hideous ignorance.
And they're really, I mean, it goes to that, kind of like what was said at the start of the movie about the code, you know, and how, you know, everyone is, I mean, they're having a good time and they're just kind of relaxed and all that stuff. But then she says, you know, freaks. And then it's yes. like a tire screech, you know, it's just like everything stops and it's like, you've done something wrong.
Right. You've wronged one of them and now you've wronged all of them. Yeah. I mean, yes. But of course she's wronged all of them. She's slurred them all. I was just watching a moment where Johnny Ek is standing on one hand and conducting like with a baton as they all sing. And he's just balancing perfectly on one. I mean, the physical agility that guy had in spite of all his disadvantages is just stunning. Wow. Yeah. There's obviously a coda to this where they're back in their cabin and Cleopatra realizes she screwed up and what she did is, you know, self-defeating to her ends. And she's apologizing to him and Hercules is saying, oh, you know, there's nothing wrong with us. There's over. They make the mistake of assuming that because Hans does not look like them, that he's not as smart as them. And you know, what we do start realizing is despite his kind of misguided infatuation with Cleopatra, he's obviously just as clever as anybody. And as the other members of the carnival are now pretty convinced that Cleopatra's up to no good. Now he's starting to finally come around to that and suspect that the same thing as she starts giving him medicine, that's making him sicker and sicker. And then he finally passes out, and the doctor's called. Doctor determines he's been poisoned. So, you know, I don't know what I don't know what Cleopatra's thought, like what's the plan now that yes, he's been poisoned, what their excuse is that, you know, how he got poisoned. I don't know exactly what their, maybe it was cut out.
It could have been.
There's definitely bits here where you can see where the lifts happen, I think.
Yeah.
There's some odd like transitions and you're like, oh, okay, we're here. So I think that's part of it. Venus tells Hercules that Venus can tell Hercules is nervous. Like the doctor's there and all this stuff's going down. And Venus is the one who actually goes and confronts her ex, obviously Hercules. And she has this great line where she says, my people are decent circus folks, not dirty rats that would kill a freak to get his money.
Yeah.
Which is a great, decent circus folks.
Decent.
So, you know, here's the plan, is growing towards this inevitable thing where, you know, they're all being spied on and everything. And it reaches a point where there's going to be they're at the next town, I guess, and there's going to be a performance. And Hans is bedridden, and you know there's some of his friends are there, and Cleopatra's taking care of him, and she goes to fill the thing with poison, and realizes that they're all watching her. So, you know. And there's a great moment where the one guy pulls out a switchblade, and then Johnny Ek pulls a Luger out from his coat. He's standing on one hand and he's pointing the gun at her with the other, and it's just it's excellent. And it's scary. That's the thing, is what I like is that these characters get to a point where like they're on to you and they're watching you and stuff like that. It gets inherently spooky, that it, because they're not like one by one, they're probably not that physically threatening, but as a group, right now, even to someone like Hercules, as we're going to see in a bit, they can be definitely a danger when pushed, even these peaceful folk. And I think that's, you know, the fable part of the story that pays off.
Yeah, definitely. And I, you know, we've talked about this, the start here about something the horrifying part that Todd Browning leaned into. Again, I have to praise a little bit of the subtlety here, because in the scene when he sits up and she realizes that they all saw her, you know, pouring in the poison, and she just looks around and she has this like look of sheer terror on her face, and like they're just, you know, one guy has a knife in his hand, one guy's, you know, wiping down his gun, and like nobody's saying anything, nobody, they're all just staring at her, and it is creepy. It is very creepy.
It's great. And there's never any, you know, Venus threatens Hercules, saying like she's going to go to the cops and tell him what he's doing. And that would be like her probable like solution to the problem, right? The non-normative guys, like, they're never even going to consider calling the police. Like, they're going to take care of this themselves, right? Like, that's this whole idea of them existing outside of our culture. They probably know by experience that them going to the police, they're not going to be taken seriously, or they're not going to be treated fairly. So that's never even a consideration. They have their own law.
Their own code.
The carnival's moving, and it's raining. And you know, they're slogging through the mud and everything. Frida tells, I think Frida's the one who's in the know, and she tells Frozo that Venus is in danger. And so he, you know, hops out to go see what's going on. And sure enough, Hercules has gone out of his cart, and he's gone around to Venus's, and he's going to take care of her. So that she can't, as she threatened, go to the cops. Frozo charges in and grabs him as he's coming for her, and they fight. And they have this, like, I like this fight between these two guys in this tiny little, you know, rolling wagon. And it's a good, you know, some of these fights from this era of movies are pretty dynamic, and some of them are less so, as we've covered on the show.
Yeah.
But this one's pretty badass, and Frozo even, he gets thrown on the stove and catches on fire in this tiny space. I mean, it's really like, yoinks. Okay. And I think the main part is like Frozo's not going to win this fight, and he's not going to be able to defeat Hercules. The guy's just too big and too strong and too tough and whatever. Yeah. But it's when he tries to escape, and then the freaks, you know, quote freaks are all there, and they start coming for him. And I guess he's hurt a little bit, because the when he falls out or something like that, there's something going on with Hercules where he can't just run fully away with the rain and all that stuff that's going on. But here's this famous scene where we see like all these characters, they're crawling from under the wagons. And they all have,
yes,
they all have knives. They all have to the point where I love Prince Randian, who's the guy with no arms or legs, has a knife in his teeth, and he's crawling with it.
just moving his torso.
His plan is to
moral support.
He'll bring the knife. He'll bring the knife to somebody else.
Yes,
you know. But even like one of the quote Pinhead characters is crawling with a knife and everything like that. It's just, you know, it does play on our inherent bias, right, of these people who don't look like what we think of as a normal person coming at you in a threatening way, and they look unusual, and yes, of course, and they move unusually, yes, okay. But to me, it's like you enjoy, you're on, because you're on their side, so you enjoy Hercules's terror, at what's happening here. At the same time, it's just one of my favorite scenes in movies ever, really, because it's so bonkers crazy. There's not that much reason for them all to be crawling, except that, you know, Hercules is kind of down on the ground now too, and I think it's just great. It's poetic, and I love it
very much. And I also enjoy how, again, this is kind of typical of the time that, you know, Wallace Ford is, his character is set up as the, you know, the hero, so to speak. And
yeah,
I think traditionally, you know, you'd have some scuffle with like the Hercules guy and you'd see Wallace Ford somehow, you know, defeat him and come on top not even close. I mean,
at the last minute he'd come and punch him out. Right. Exactly. Yeah, rah, America. Exactly. But that's not what happens.
No, but it's also true to form. I mean, Hercules is a strong man that wrestles bulls. Yeah, yeah. Wallace Ford is a clown. So of course he's going to get literally killed by this guy.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's only the strength of the numbers, which is, yeah, like the theme of the film. Cleopatra, I think that her wagon tips and Cleopatra flees, and we see her being similarly chased down by the other members, like Johnny Eck and a few of the other members. And we cut to, or we fade at least, to the other part of the bookend story of this carnival barker talking about her fate. And the part of it we do see that was not edited out is we pan down and we see Cleopatra in this little pen at this freak show, and she has been, well, one of her eyes is missing and she has no legs. She has no arms now. They've been sort of turned into sort of feathered wing things. And she has a tail, and they've turned her into kind of a duck woman.
Yeah.
It's not exactly explained how that happens, but that's okay. It is very prophetic, and it's, you know, they obviously take from both of them the thing I think they prize most. They take from Cleopatra her beauty, right, and turn her into something else.
Yeah,
and in the deleted scene, what we don't see is the implication is when they catch up to Hercules, they castrate him. So in a deleted scene, there was a moment where you see Hercules at this same show and he's singing, but he's singing in a falsetto voice because he's been castrated. So, you know, in a way it's like they don't kill Hercules, but they take away obviously the thing that he seems to prize most, obviously. But one might argue the thing he thinks with, right?
Yes. What he thinks makes him a man.
Right, exactly. So their revenge on these characters is to remove the thing that they use most to get what they want. And then we have a final scene, which some of the things I read seem to indicate that this might have been an added scene. This might have been shot afterwards. I don't know, because it does seem a little Hollywood, maybe, to me, more so than the rest of the film, right? Where Hans has inherited his fortune, and he's living in this mansion with a giant hearth and a butler, and Frozo and Venus bring Frida to him, and she's wearing like a little fox stole and everything. They're all dressed nicely now. And I guess the implication is that Hans walked away from it all after what happened to Hercules and Cleopatra, kind of ashamed that his, you know, self-delusion sort of initiated these events. He blames himself, I guess, that bad things happened. But Frida comes to him and, you know, she still loves him and she still, you know, wants to be with him and everything. So they kind of have a reconciliation. And the nice thing is we sort of have this moment where we get to see Frozo and Venus dressed up and really, you know, nice. And I think the assumption is that once Hans inherits all his money, he sort of gives a lot of it to everybody else. So in the end, all the members of the sideshow end up being quite well off and not having to, you know, put themselves in front of the public in the same way to be, you know, jeered at and mocked and what have you. So,
right.
Sort of the rare sort of happy ending in a Browning film, I guess, which is why I say it's maybe not typical. Maybe it was added. I'm not sure.
I know. Well, that brings a good point is that, again, you know, watching this on the recent Criterion Collection disc, this scene is so such a poor quality compared to the rest of the movie. And so it would make sense that, you know, something is maybe not as preserved or came from a different source or what have you.
Right. No, noticeably different looking. It looks like a 60 millimeter blow up to me, but I'm not sure. I don't know if your version has it, the regular old DVD version I bought years ago that I have it on, has a commentary by David Scall, our late, master commentator and expert on films of this era. So, maybe after this, I will sit and listen to that. I do try not to listen to the commentaries on my movies before we talk about them, cause I want to kind of bring my own interpretation. But, having said that, I'm sure there's lots of fascinating information, from Mr. Scall on this. Well, we got through that. Again, you know, it's something this is a film I've wanted to talk about for a while on the show, but I've always wanted to make sure that we were respectful to the talented folks that came and, you know, put themselves on camera for the film. And I think we managed to weed our way through it. Whatever. You know, it's funny because there's not a heck of a lot of story to the movie. Like this, I'm just realizing we got through this very quickly. And I think first of all, it's an hour long, but also, you know, not that much happens in the movie. It's again, like I said, more, it follows more like a fable than a narrative. This happens. And then there you go. Okay. It's like a bedtime story almost.
I'm going to say that to my kids.
Like an awful, awful.
I'm going to start that tonight. Yeah. You know, let me tell you a story,
start telling
children.
Tell me a story about the bird woman.
Yes. Let's turn off the lights and let's.
And the human torso. Yeah. I'll put up some pictures so you can know what I'm talking
about. Some visual aid.
Yes, exactly. My understanding, I mean, this film's now on a bunch of lists of movies, like, you know, the whole like X amount of movies you should watch before you die and X amount of like the most like amazing thrillers in history and whatnot. I mean, it has come into its own to be appreciated, I think, on the merits of what Browning was trying to accomplish with it, rather than just on the surface level of look how outrageous it is, what have you. So that's good to know. I guess I would say next to Dracula, it's Browning's most famous film easily.
Yes, he is. Yeah, that's pretty much what he's known for today is Dracula and Freaks.
He made Dracula, and then he made this insane freaking film.
But you do have to give him credit. I mean, we can criticize his style or sometimes his lack thereof, but this movie was absolutely ahead of its time, just in terms of the story and how they framed these characters that were, especially in the 30s, are so traditionally the outcasts, the you know, the butt of the jokes, the villains. It's not really the glitzy, perfect looking, you know, male female duo that's the hero of everything. It is all about this band of this community of people who just happen to be different. And he kind of, he celebrates that, and he makes the story to where it puts them over in a good light, and you feel sympathy for him. So you have to give him credit for that.
I think there's a lot of freaks in Goonies. I mean, the 1980s film Goonies. I think there's a lot of this movie in that there are, you know, a group of outcasts that come to celebrate themselves. I have I'll just finish it with a great anecdote. I know an actor named Dean Cameron, who many of you might know from a couple of movies, but he was in Summer School, the Carl Reiner film from the 1989, 1990 or whatever, which is again about a bunch of misfits who have to go to summer school together because they failed English class, and Mark Harmon is their teacher and he doesn't want to be there. And it's a great comedy. It's one of my favorite little comedies from the era and stuff like that. It's awesome. Anyway, Dean plays a character named Chainsaw, who is obsessed with horror movies along with his friend Dave. And they con the teacher into showing a movie in class as an assignment. And the original intent was that they were going to show in the final film, they watched the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and it dovetails with the fact that Chainsaw, that's his nickname. In the original version and in the scripted version, it was supposed to be Freaks. And it was intentionally there because the characters in summer school, all the students are sort of freaks, and the idea is that it dovetails. Carl Reiner, apparently, Carl Reiner from, you know, Dick Van Dyke Show and so many other things, obviously, such a lauded and wonderful comedian and writer and creator of the latter 20th century, had never seen Freaks. And so he sat down to watch it at the Warner Brothers, I want to say it's Warner Brothers, maybe it's Paramount, I can't remember, screening room with a bunch of the cast. And Dean, my friend, was there watching it, thinking, wow, like, this is gonna be great. And I guess Carl Reiner stands up at the end and he's like, and there is no effing way we are putting this in the movie. and then it became Texas Chainsaw Massacre was the more sane option compared to Todd Browning's Freaks. So there we go. That's my closest interaction I have. I'm like 3 degrees away from Todd Browning's Freaks. There you go. I just think that, Dean told me that story the first time we met. I thought that was really funny. Knowing that I'm who I am and I would know what Freaks, the movie is, obviously, as well. There we go. Everybody, thank you so much for sitting around and listening to, us talk about this one. It's nice when we can go back and hit another 30s film, right? Livio, we've covered quite a few of them, and it's nice when we can come back to this initial first couple years of, sound horror.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not a renaissance. It's the first sans. I don't know. right, because the renaissance is like a hearkening back to something, so it's like, anyway, never mind. Wow, we got through that. Anyway, everybody, thank you so much for listening. This is Jim Towns. We have quite a few other episodes in our library, so please check us out on your favorite podcast platform if you haven't. And you have a bunch of episodes you can go back and listen to with me and Livio, some other guest hosts recently, and of course our original co-host Scott is on a bunch of those as well. We will be coming back to you in a few weeks. Please check out our Facebook and Instagram pages, where we are quite active and interact with our listenership quite a bit. We have a great community going on there, and we will see you next time. Thanks, everybody.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode, but the fun does not stop here. You can follow and interact with the show's hosts and listeners online on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Borgo Pass Horror Podcast is a presentation of Shadow Camera Film and Entertainment. This episode was edited by Livio Marino. The music was composed by Sean Poole. Opening and closing narration are by me, Kat Ahrens. Show titles and graphics created by Jim Towns. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Borgo Pass Horror Podcast.